You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church. You have not once just texted me and said, I totally forgot that we were recording. So like, and I've had that with other people that I've been on podcasts with. So nothing. There is no other religious movement in the history of civilization that has been as globally transmissible as the Christian faith, full stop.
It is so worth it to start to build yourself into or to become built into a local community of brothers and sisters in Christ. The Christian faith is not, we are robbing ourselves and others if we act like it is. This is Rebecca McLaughlin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kyle Worley.
Yeah, you are. How's it going?
It is going only okay, but that's all right. Okay. That's all right. We're still alive here.
Yeah, great. That's good.
Kyle, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Are you an organized person?
Very, very, very organized. I'm an organized person. Yes. Here is my planner right here with all of my weekly, monthly, dailies in it and reflections and lots of checkboxes. I am such a taskless oriented person. I write all of my to-do list things in here. I also put them digitally so I get to check two boxes for any one task.
That's amazing.
So yes, I am a organized person and I am very gratified by checking things off of a list.
Gosh, I'm impressed. I am a profoundly disorganized person. Like I don't think, if I tried to keep a checklist, it would have three items and then I'd start writing something else. And then I'd forget about the things that I wrote in the first place. And then I wouldn't check them off. I mean, like, I could sit down and try and do what you do, and it would unravel within a day. I'm just, it's not how I
get
live
that.
And breathe.
I get that. You know, but you know what? I think you're not giving yourself enough credit because you got a lot of irons in the fire, and you have not once just texted me and said, I totally forgot that we were recording. So, like, and I've had that with other people that I've been on podcasts with.
So here's one thing in my favor. I'm very punctual.
Okay. All right.
Are you on time?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So yeah, I'm disorganized, and I'm untidy, but I am punctual. So that's something.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So that kind of course corrects probably.
There's one thing that I really, really hate. I mean, I hate when people are late in general, but I really hate being late to church.
Ooh.
So I'm one of those.
Come give a talk at my hotel, please.
I'm like the grumpy mother and wife who's like haranguing everyone because we need to get to church on time. Like it really distresses me if we're not at church on time.
Here's the thing, and this is maybe just the thing that we allowed culturally to set in that we've never been able to effectively reset. If you were sitting in the Mosaic worship space at 9:57, we start at 10.
You're alone.
You'll think, wow, there is not many people at this church. At 10 o'clock, you'll go, huh, it seems like people are finally starting to come in here. And then at 10:05, you'll be like, oh, there's not a seat.
Interesting.
But like at 9:57, 3 minutes before we start, you'll look around the room and go, I mean, there have been many Sundays where I've looked around the room and go, man, the sermon last week was that bad, huh?
Like, just didn't come
back. They're just like, I am done forever. So, we're going to have to get you in to give you like something on like the Trinity and timeliness or personal holiness and promptness.
Excellent.
Or punctuality.
Excellent. I'll give a talk between 10 and 10:05. And if people aren't there, they're just going to miss it.
Perfect.
I don't know about you, Carl, but I feel like up in New England where I live, there are a lot of people who are skeptical of what you're going to see my cunning segue here. Mm-hmm. They are skeptical of organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a phenomenon in Texas of people?
Yeah, probably not at the same degree that our Northeastern neighbors and brothers and sisters experience, just because, you know, you guys are always a little bit further ahead in terms of some of the cultural winds, but there is, you'll probably still find like a general respect and like reverence for the institutions of organized religion in a place like Texas in maybe a way that you wouldn't find it elsewhere. But yes, in the last 10 years of doing ministry in North Texas, I say 10 years, it's been over 10 years now, of doing ministry in North Texas, the winds of change have shifted in terms of how people view the value, the role, the importance, the beauty, the benefit of organized expressions of religion, in particular Christianity.
And do you think people are more oriented toward, like, you know, maybe see themselves as spiritual, but not religious, or maybe they see themselves as like even religious, but not wanting to be a regular member of a religious community? You know, maybe somebody would say, yeah, I'm definitely a Christian, but like, I'm not really somebody who goes to church, or I'm definitely identified as Jewish, but I don't really have any connection with the local shul.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that you said it. Yeah, spiritual but not religious. I would say that what's becoming increasingly common in these parts is I'm religious but I'm not spiritual. Meaning people deeply, deeply want to participate in what in any spiritual context would be obviously religious. Meaning habits, routines, rituals that they believe offer some material and immaterial benefit for the sake of their self-care or well-being. And I would say that there is a lot of interest in, like, let me just give a really basic example of an institution that is very dense in North Texas and that is intentionally subversively religious in its design, CrossFit.
I was thinking you must be going for CrossFit there.
CrossFit is, and it's like no surprise, you can go find some panels where the guys who started CrossFit will be like, we looked at what made religious communities sticky and we said, we're going to do the exact same thing. And that's what we did. And they did that. But you could look at a lot of other things, SoulCycle, Peloton. I mean, these are, I'm not like venturing these out as some sort of novel, new observations. Many Christian scholars and sociologists of religion and cultural examiners have made the same observation. And I would say that is particularly persuasive to people in the South, in Texas in particular, that have all of the rhythms and routines. They almost have an engine culturally, explicitly or implicitly, that was trained for the religious life, but they've lost any sort of real belief in the meaningfully supernatural or the truthfully spiritual, but they still feel like, man, that muscle memory has to go somewhere. And boy, oh boy, are there now more secular, so to speak, or a-spiritual opportunities to do that very thing.
Gosh, that's fascinating. Yeah, there's a guy over at Harvard. I don't like to talk about Harvard much because, you know, Harvard. But I am in Harvard's backyard. I'm like I'm more in MIT's backyard here, but I'm like kind of in Harvard's backyard. And there's a guy over at the Harvard School of Public Health named Tyler Vanderveel, who heads up a research group that is looking at the mental and physical health benefits of religious participation. And it's completely fascinating because a lot of people assume that being regularly involved in religious community is like psychologically harmful. You know, there's certainly this kind of quorum of people who would think actually many of the bad things that people feel and, you know, mental health problems they have arise from religious practice. Then there's a whole another group of people who would think, yeah, I mean, I can see how having a regular rhythm, having social connection with the same people you show up and see on a Sunday every morning, you know, every Sunday morning, kind of having that sense of community could be good for your psychological health. But we don't need that to be a religious thing. You know, the examples you gave, kind of substituting athletic or kind of physical activity for the religious gap there. What Tyler and his team have found sort of fascinatingly is that actually not only is regular religious participation, like say going to church once a week or more, meaningfully good for your mental and physical health, but that it's actually not just the social support. In fact, the social support seems to account for about 30% of the effect. It seems like the actual religious element of it is also really important. And as I say, the benefits, like fascinatingly, are not only psychological, but also physical. You are less likely to die in the next 15 years if you are a regular church attender than if you're not.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. I was trying to figure out a way to like capture this sentiment. I've been reading for a long time, this guy out of the UK who maybe you're familiar with, Alain de Botton.
Yeah.
He's written a lot and he has this book called Religion for Atheists. Mm. And I was trying to figure out a way to sum it up, but I actually found a review of it and it's really short. Can
Go
I read
for
it real quick?
Go for it.
Because I think it's really a good picture of exactly what we're talking about here. So bear with me. And if you're really interested in exploring some of what, because maybe you're hearing this, you're like, what? You're telling me that religion for atheists, that's an oxymoron, right? Listen to this. This is the description of this book by a reviewer. What if religions are neither all true or all nonsense? The boring debate between fundamentalist believers and non-believers is finally moved on by Elaine's book, Religion for Atheists, which argues that the supernatural claims of religion are, of course, entirely false. So there you go. And yet religions still have something very important things to teach the secular world. Religion for Atheists suggests that rather than mocking religions, agnostics and atheists should instead steal from them because they're packed with good ideas on how we might live and arrange our societies. Blending deep respect with total impiety, Elaine, a non-believer himself, proposes that we should look to religions for insights into, among other concerns, how to build a sense of community, make our relationships last, overcome feelings of envy and inadequacy, escape the 24-hour media, go traveling, get more out of art, architecture, and music, and create new businesses designed to address our emotional needs. When you hear it, you're like, whoa, like it kind of fries your mind for a second because here's a person who's saying, I am a non-believer. Mm-hmm. I think the claims of religion are entirely false, like out of hand, boom. I'm like, I am sequestering them away into the realm of falsehood. But I really like the social and psychological benefits that religion has historically been used as a vehicle to provide. And these church for atheists have sprung up all over the world. There's a couple of them right here in Dallas where there is a group that meets every week on a Sunday morning. They get together, they read selections of poetry or prose, they sing some songs. It's a church service that is entirely, that in no way presumes, articulates, believes, or encourages the belief in anything that we would traditionally classify as explicitly religious, meaning supernatural mm-hmm. truth claims about God or the world or the other. And it's fascinating, right?
I mean, sort of. I think one of the interesting things about living in, not only in the West, but in the sort of specific pockets of the West, which see themselves as sort of center of education and, you know, where thinking should be and what all reasonable and well-educated people should and shouldn't think. It's certainly something that kind of comes out of the UK. And that sense that you can just dismiss religious belief as like evidently untrue. So we're not even having that conversation anymore. Like the world has moved on from that conversation. So what can we harvest?
Right.
It's a wildly arrogant way to conduct yourself at the end of the day when globally religious belief in general and Christianity in particular is thriving and that its major competitor is actually Islam, not a sort of Diet Coke version of Buddhism, for example, which seems to be the most acceptable religious sure. view, you know, where I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I've never heard diet.
Well, do you know what I mean? Like the sort of.
I know. It's a phrase that I've never heard before, and I knew exactly what you meant. So I'm going to be using that moving on.
There's a piece of me that kind of wants to say good luck to those atheist churches. They're not going to go anywhere because what they can't offer people is hope.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, they can't. And solidarity isn't enough.
Yeah.
And I don't think community as an organizing principle is compelling enough. And I definitely don't think social solidarity is enough. We have plenty of evidence throughout history that social, political, economic solidarity is not sufficient to maintain a movement.
Yeah.
We have it in spades. So I don't think that these local outposts of irreligious religious practice, so to speak, are sustainable because you're right. They miss a very driving engine. They don't have a foundation of truth, and they don't have an ethic of hope that can compel a life of love.
Yeah, and I'm sort of fascinated by the demographics of those groups as well. Up here in the Northeast, at least, the demographics of churches that have kind of from the other direction arrived in a similar place, i.e. they're not really mm-hmm. holding to the a serious engagement with the scriptures or serious beliefs sure. in the truth claims of Christianity, but are wanting to kind of continue with church as a positive social experience and maybe as a base for some sort of positive social action in the world. The demographics of those churches tend to be older white folk. Now, as a white person who is only getting older, I mean no disrespect to older white people, but it's just sort of fascinating how
oh for sure
there is a distinct lack of diversity among those groups. Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, Seminary President Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold.
Yeah, I read an article, and I'd have to go hunt to find it. It was fascinating, but it was a non-Christian black journalist who went to one of these churches for atheists, and it was in California. Mm. I forget whether it was San Francisco or LA, but it was one of the two, and they were reporting on what they had seen and what their experience of the event had been. And one of the things that they came back very critical of was that all of the sacred text, well, one, that the room was almost 100% homogenate or the same, but the sacred text, so to speak, and were all Eurocentric. Mm. I remember listening to Harry Potter is a Sacred Text. It was a podcast that was very popular for a number of years in the religion and spirituality category. It came out of Harvard Divinity School. And it was fascinating. As a fan of the series, I was very interested in what they were talking about. I listened to, I would say, the overwhelming bulk of the show. And one time I passed it on to a couple of other pastor friends of mine, some of whom were not white pastors. And it occurred to me, and I'm not making any judgment about the demographics of people who've read Harry Potter, but other people who are my same age, I passed it on to them and said, guys, we should probably be aware of Harry Potter. And this is a good podcast because it's such a central shared text for our culture. And do you know, all of the white pastors I sent it on to were like, yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's good. Thank you for sharing this podcast. The pastors of color that I sent it on to, who were operating in spaces very different from mine, made the most interesting observation, which is, I don't know a single person who has read Harry Potter or watched the movies.
Yeah, yeah. We can often think we're speaking to much larger groups than we in fact are.
And I make that point to say that, like, organized religion has to have for it to not end up as just a absolutely culturally situated reality, it has to have global and historic roots. And nothing has global and historic roots like Christianity.
Yeah.
Nothing. There is no other religious movement in the history of civilization that has been as globally transmissible as the Christian faith, full stop.
Indeed.
And you don't have to be a Christian historian or sociologist to make that observation. It is
just
painstakingly
just
clear.
The facts. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just the facts.
So let's just pivot there a bit, Kyle, and think about the folks. So there are some people who'd say, yeah, I'm not into organized religion, but I want some of the benefits of it. So I'm going to maybe go to a sort of church for atheists or to CrossFit. And not to say, I mean, a Christian could go to CrossFit and that'd be just fine, but somebody to go and seek that need to be met there. My guess is there'll also be people listening to us today who would say, you know, I'm a follower of Jesus. Like I really, mm-hmm. really believe the gospel, but I've maybe had some bad experiences in church, or I haven't felt like I found a church that has met my needs. And I, at this point in my life, feel like I'm better to kind of operate as a Christian aside from a local church community. Yeah. Or that, you know, maybe it'd be ideal to be part of a local church community, but I just haven't, you know, I've moved to a new city. I haven't found a church to be part of. And that seems to be working like okay for me now. What would you say to folks in that situation?
Yeah, well, speaking to like it broadly, I'd also want to just note what we do hear many times. We don't do it because we're trying to caveat it to death, but just to say, at the level of the person, there are 100 qualifying contextual factors that come into addressing this. So when Rebecca and I ask each other these kinds of questions, we're speaking under the umbrella of like, here is a general course that I would take based off of having a complete blind experience of who I'm actually talking to. So that's the big note. But I think that with that general sentiment, I might ask a few questions. Are there any communal institutions in the world that where we should not expect to find some degree of brokenness and problems? Any? Fraternities, sororities, governments, partnerships,
yep.
You know, clubs, social organizations. Do you think that any of them, anywhere, will be perfect? And most people will go, no. And then I might go, well, why? They go, well, because nobody's perfect. And if social organizations are a conglomeration or aggregation of people, then you're going to find brokenness institutionally the way that you find brokenness individually, because institutions are made up of individuals. Okay. So now we know that the terms upon which our life together is going to operate will always be as a partly broken person among other partly broken people. So if you're asking for a church to be exempt from that reality, I do not think that you're going to be consistent across other groups. You'll either find yourself in a radically isolated life as a Christian, or you'll find yourself just entangled in another community that will also be broken. Now, if it is either radical isolation or life together with other broken people, would you like to be a part of life together with other broken people where there is a stated belief that we're all broken people here in need of the gospel? Or do you think that would be a healthier ecosystem? Or do you think it would be healthier for there to not be a stated core belief that we need help? Which one do you think would be more honest, humble, generous, and kind? Probably the one where there's a stated core belief that we're all broken and need help, right? And if you go, yes, they go, oh, and then I go, but that's not been my experience. I go, I'm really, really sorry for that. There are a lot of churches to where that's a stated belief in principle, but not one in practice. Let's help you find one where it's not just a confessional thing, it's a culture thing, because that'll be a healthy church, and those healthy churches do exist where you are.
Yeah.
That's probably how I'd have that conversation.
Yeah, I think I find the scriptural understanding of the church as family really helpful here for two reasons. One, because it communicates what churches actually should be, not just something I show up to on a Sunday if it's convenient that week and, you know, maybe say hi to a couple of people, but like, actually, this is my kind of base family. Mm-hmm. But also because whereas many of us will have experienced really hard things in the context of family, very few of us would say, therefore, we should abolish the family.
Sure.
You know, there might be people listening today who were tragically, like physically abused in the context of their family of origin, and for whom it would be very understandable for them to feel disillusioned with family.
Right.
But even for those people, and perhaps even especially for those people, finding perhaps as adults being able to build a family that is not an abusive place, but that is a loving and nurturing place, will be mm-hmm. profoundly healing for them.
Yeah.
And likewise, I think for those of us who've been deeply hurt in church context, whether it's by abusive leadership or whether it's by, you know, individuals within the church who've been profoundly hurting others, or whether it's just you know, scenarios where relationships have got broken and where things have been really hard. Mm-hmm. That rather than giving up on church as a result of that, we need to lean into church and seek to redeem that experience. What would you call? So I know I'm speaking to a pastor here. If you were seeking to recommend a church to somebody, mm-hmm. like say they've showed up in a new town and they're thinking, well, I'd like to find a new church community, but there are so many options. I don't really know where to start or what kind of thing I should be looking for, or like what would be signs that I should, you know, warning signs versus kind of come right in signs.
Yeah.
Give us a couple of thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, I'd find a church that's close to you. I'd find a church that's close to you if you can. Meaning, if you come to me and said, hey, there are some secondary and like tertiary things that like I might have like some subtle distinct like differences with, and it doesn't match all my preferences, but there's a church that has healthy leadership and is faithful to the gospel and they're close to me. Can I, like, what church should I go to? There's a church that's a little bit further down that, like, we're in complete alignment. And I'd be like, oh, go to the closer one. So that's one thing, but that's more, not a prescription.
I agree, Carl, but just give us a second on why that is. Why does it matter?
Well, one, it's a way of putting to death your preferences. Mm-hmm. Two, it's a way of prioritizing that mission is the easiest thing to draw away from, and where a church worships typically anchors its missional life. And it's very easy if you worship in a place that you're not actually living in to have a transactional relationship with the people mm-hmm. who have the best opportunity to hear the gospel from the people of that mm-hmm. church.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that, and I think places matter to God. And I think where the church worships, it offers a consecration benefit to a local community. So anyways, those are my thoughts on that. Beyond that, you're looking for healthy and humble leadership. You're not looking for perfect leaders. I would say prioritize healthy and humble yeah. over dynamic yes. and gifted.
Amen, 1,000 times.
100 out of 100. Just because dynamic and gifted, those are not bad things. Listen, thank God for dynamic and gifted churches, ministries, pastors, and preachers who are also wholly humble and healthy. Praise God. And they're not mutually exclusive realities. But if you have to have one or the other, I'd go with holy and humble yeah. and healthy yeah. over dynamic and gifted every day of the yeah. week and twice on Sunday. So
I find it fascinating, just to break in there, when you look at the list that we have in the New Testament of like qualifications for elders and thinking about pastors as sort of within the elder category. We in our church culture, honestly, if we were putting down a list of qualifications for elders, we'd probably like start with, oh, well, he's got to be a great preacher. He's got to be like super dynamic. Yeah. He's got to be a great leader. He's got to be the kind of person around who, you know, we would sort of instinctively foreground those things. And actually the yeah. lists foreground character. It's not that competence doesn't matter. You know, they need to be able to teach, but actually mm-hmm. it's character, character, character.
Yep.
And that's right. I think that's wisdom for us.
That's my, like, holy, humble, and healthy yeah. in the leadership and faithful to the central tenets of the gospel as outlined in the creeds and the Apostles Nicaea and Chalcedon. If those two things are there and the church is practicing the ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper, I would, and they're close, go
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with all of that. And I know that you would include this as well, but a church that is seeking to faithfully teach through the Bible.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the end of the day, no pastor is that interesting. The most dynamic pastor in the world ain't got that much to say. what we need is somebody who's going to be walking us through the scriptures. And so finding a church that's doing that faithfully, when I say faithfully, I mean like keeping close to the text, is the best way for us to deduce that typically.
That's right.
As I look for a church, and we did this once when we moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts 15 years ago, I was very much trained in the UK to not shop around for churches. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, because you can move to a new city and like spend 3 months trying a different church every week until you find your perfect fit. Actually, that's 3 months that you've spent not embedded in Christian community and not putting down roots, and instead sort of seeking for the bigger, better deal. And I'm putting that slightly brutally, but it can often lead people to feel quite unmoored as in their Christian faith.
Yeah.
So I'd say, you know, try to close in on a church really quite quickly. I'm always looking for a church that I feel like I could invite a non-Christian friend to.
Yeah.
And that it would be a relatively, it wouldn't be one that would introduce a bunch of kind of additional barriers to the offense of the gospel. So a church where I could, I feel like people would be welcomed and not feel sort of alienated and put off by the style or the culture or, you know, the certain features like that would be something that I would look for. And a church where there is a seriousness about community and about mission.
Yeah.
Not just a church that's seeking to kind of, you know, check the box on a Sunday morning, but a church that is serious about advancing the gospel and building disciples. All of that goes hand in hand with the things that you were flagging for us, Kyle. I think it's almost impossible to overestimate the importance of very regular church participation. Mm. And I want to say participation rather than attendance, because attendance sort of sounds like you showed up, you sat there, you went away. participation, going and singing your heart out, praying with those around you, seeking to welcome others as Christ has welcomed us. Not just seeing yourself as a consumer, but as a part of that family and as a contributor and a part of that community, and doing that week in, week out with the same mixed up bunch of people of all ages, of all backgrounds, of all socioeconomic, of all racial backgrounds, if that's possible in your local community.
So we shouldn't abandon organized religion.
Even very disorganized people like me. Yeah.
Oh, now I see what you were doing.
Only just now?
Oh, my goodness, Rebecca. Oh, man, that's classic British understatement right there. You didn't even, like, I would have been like, did you see what I did right there? You know what I'm saying? Like, I would have made the move and then made it so obvious. It would have been unmissable. It just occurred to me. That's why you started. Wow, that's a pro move.
Well, apparently, no, it's a complete fail because even you didn't get the connection.
No, it was graceful. Okay. So that was a great line. And then I stomped all over it with my realization of what you were doing. Should we abandon organized religion? No. We should probably abandon bad organized religion or organized bad religion. But we shouldn't be afraid of using the word religion. James talks about true religion. And it sounds pretty good what James has in mind. And so I think that when we think about this question, no, we shouldn't abandon organized religion. We should abandon unfaithful, unholy, unvirtuous, ungospel, unevangelistic, undiscipleship oriented, unbiblical religion. Yes, that religion we should abandon. But if we're talking about the way of Jesus lived out among his followers and dwelt by the Holy Spirit and led by under shepherds, no, we should not abandon that. We should cultivate it, invest in it, deepen it, enrich it together with one voice, even as we are different, one body with many members. We should strengthen it because it's not just good for us, it's good for the world. All right. Well, we just solved that one. Check that one off the box. No, I mean, seriously though, like if you're somebody who has been hurt by the church and we've spoken in some general norms, talk with somebody. Don't just talk with other people who despise the church. Maybe you're in a place where you're like, I hate the church. I despise it. Maybe your hurt runs that deep. Don't just talk with other people who despise it. Talk with other people who love it and love you and see if just maybe there is an invitation that's extended to you into something different.
Mm, mm.
Consider that.
Yeah, and just as an encouragement as well, I think there's a sense in which church shouldn't be easy, actually. Many of the best things in life are not easy. And what do I mean by that? I think building real community takes real work and intentionality, and especially if we are doing the profoundly Christian thing of building community across difference, and build a community with people who we may not actually have much in common with aside from our faith in Jesus. And You know, the church I go to, there are some people with whom I have a very easy natural rapport and tons in common, and, you know, it's all kind of easy. And there are other people who I have to work really hard to think, you know, what would be a meaningful question to ask this person about their week, or how can I listen well to this person and serve and help them, given that their background and their life experience is completely different from mine. So I think church at its best should be take real work, just as, you know, parenting takes real work. Being married to some, like building a healthy marriage takes real work. Friendship takes real work. I think church should be something that takes work, and there'll be most likely for people who haven't been in church in a while, there'll be that barrier to get over of like walking in for the first time. Where will I sit? Who will I talk to? This will feel odd. Will people ask me awkward questions? Just to be encouraged to push through those barriers. It is so worth it to start to build yourself into, or to become built into, a local community of brothers and sisters in Christ. The Christian faith is not a solo sport, and we're robbing ourselves and others if we act like it is.
Love that. All right. Well, listen, if you want to find out more about Confronting Christianity, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter. Leave a review on iTunes, and your review include a future question. We'll consider it for future episodes. If you want to find out more about how you can check out other podcasts on our network, support what we're doing here, go to trainthechurch.com/support. We hope you enjoyed the discussion today. Grace and peace.